and Health and Social Services Committee meeting will now come to order. It is 3:05 p.m. on Thursday, April 13th in Capitol Room 106. Members present are Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Edgeman, Representative Tarr, Representative Johnston, and myself, Chair Sponholz. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take a moment to silence your phones. Take them all the way off vibrate if you can for the term duration of the meeting. Before we begin, I want to thank Butch Carber, the House HES Secretary from Records, and welcome Summers Cole from the Juneau LIO for staffing the committee for a second time in a row. And as always, thank Ted Madsen, our wonderful committee aide. Today we have three items on the agenda. First is House Bill 118, Representative Kawasaki's bill dealing with compensation for wrongful convictions. Second is Senate Bill 32, Senator Hughes' bill on prescriptions for biological products. Third is House Bill 176, Representative Zach Fansler's bill covering ground emergency medical transportation. So first, I want to invite Olivia Garrett up to the front to present on House Bill 118 by Representative Scott Kawasaki. This is the second hearing on this legislation. We will hear a recap from the bill sponsor, take public testimony, and then set the bill aside for future consideration. If you could give us a brief recap of the bill, Ms. Garrett, that would be wonderful.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Health and Social Services Committee. For the record, Olivia Garrett, staffer, Representative Scott Kawasaki. So very briefly, what this bill does is it would provide administrative process so that those who have been wrongfully convicted of crimes and subsequently served time in prison would be able to apply for compensation for their time served. The big aspect of this bill would be providing health care for those who apply and qualify for their compensation, specifically 10 years of state-funded health care coverage, and more specifically, behavioral health treatment, including treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder. Did any members of the committee want me to elaborate a little bit more?
Does anybody else need any additional information? No, I think we were all here for the first presentation, so thank you. All right, we will now open up the bill for public testimony. Bam. First off, is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify? All right, seeing none, we're going to go to the off-net first. We have Tiffany Merritt from North Carolina on the phone. Ms. Merritt?
Hi, yes, I'm here.
All right, can you introduce yourself formally and then proceed with your testimony?
Yes, my name is Tiffany Merritt. I was born and raised in Alaska, and I am now attending graduate school at the University of North Carolina in Greensboro. And I'll graduate in 3 weeks with my master's in sociology with a concentration in criminology. I have been doing research on wrongful convictions for 3 years now. In my master's research, I recently created a database that looked into how much financial redress death row exonerees receive in this country. And what I found is that basically 40% of death row exonerees receive redress, and the remainder receive nothing. In my research, I've also found that only 31 states have compensation statutes. And when I was doing this research, I was very saddened to find that my home state of Alaska does not have a compensation statute, especially since one of our own senators, Senator Ted Stevens, was wrongfully convicted and exonerated, so he is technically an exoneree. And from my research of exonerees, I found that they've had everything taken from them. They've had years of incarceration. Many of those years were workable years when they could have been obtaining job experience or going to college, and when they come out, they have a host of health problems and mental health problems, which could be addressed by this bill. And the compensation statute that's being introduced in the HB 118 is probably one of the best I've seen in my research, so I would strongly recommend we implement this because it's highly needed, and it's also mandated by the United Nations under their Article 14.6. That countries provide compensation for those who are wrongfully convicted within their borders.
Thank you for your thoughtful testimony, Ms. Merritt. Does anybody on the committee have any questions for Ms. Merritt? Thank you for calling in.
We, no problem.
At the Anchorage Legislative Information Office, we have William Harrington. Can you introduce yourself and then proceed with your testimony?
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. William Arrington here, and I represent myself as a private sector citizen rather than as a public sector employee or retiree. I think this affiliation question is very apropos, and we must recognize that the prejudices inherently attached from different sources of livelihood. Page two. I urge swift passage of this bill and suggest a member amend the bill to include past incidences which this bill seeks to correct. I spent too much time watching Channel 15, and I'm brainwashed into believing we need dignity and an Alaska we want to live in. Again, dignity and an Alaska we want to live in. A state that trusts, that treats wrongfully convicted as Alaska does now has no dignity. The famed economist John Kenneth Galbraith was asked how he could change a long-held theory of his, and he answered, "When I am wrong, I change my mind. What do you do?" It's time for Alaska's judicial system to man up to the human imperfections and the legislative and governor to send a strong message that with dignity is how government treats its citizens. Any of us could be wrongfully accused and in a bad situation. Godspeed in this task. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Harrington. Are there any questions for Mr. Harrington from the committee? All right. Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony today. It doesn't look like there's anybody else who wishes to testify, so I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony for now. Before we lose Ms. Garrett, is there anybody who has any questions for her on the scope of this bill? No? All right. Thank you very much for attending today, and we'll bring this bill up at another date. Moving expeditiously along, we're going to turn our attention to Senate Bill 32 from Senator Shelley Hughes. This is the second hearing on this legislation. We're going to hear a recap of the bill from the bill sponsor, take public testimony, and then look to the will of the committee. All right. Can you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and then give us a brief recap?
Thank you. Hello. Madam Chair and members of the House Hess Committee, my name is Amy Bushnell. I'm staff to Senator Shelley Hughes. Some of the main points of this bill as a recap is that SB 32 requires only biosimilars approved by the FDA as interchangeable can be substituted for the original prescription. This is a safety language involved to make sure that the patient is taken care of. Another safety measure involved is that there is a notification within 3 days of dispensing the product to the patient that the original prescriber must be notified. Another safety. is that if the prescriber feels that the patient should only have the product they believe is best for them, they can write dispense as written, and on the prescription, that's all they can have.
Senator Hughes, would you like to join us? And I'd also like to recognize that Representative Eastman has joined us at about 3:14. I think Ms. Bushnell is looking a lot more comfortable now that you're there with her.
Yeah, you can continue now.
Madam Chair, I'm Shelley Hughes, Senator for District F, Chugach Palmer Matt Sue, and I did just walk in, so I'm not sure exactly where you are, if she was just reviewing the bill. And
we're doing a recap of the bill.
Okay.
Explain the safety features. That's
mm-hmm. Okay. So she explained the safety features, and we talked why access to these medications are important to a number of Alaskans. And you to describe between the arrangement between the doctor and the pharmacist and the notification. I'm trying to think if there's anything else as far as that I need to mention.
Mm-hmm.
don't think so. I think we're good
yeah.
at this
yeah,
point
I'm
in time. Is there any questions for the bill sponsor before we move on to take public testimony? All right. Seeing none, we're going to move on to public testimony then, if that's all right. Let's see. I didn't know I was in the right spot. All right, it looks, I'm going to go ahead and open public testimony, and we're going to start with Robert Toms in the MATSU Legislative Information Office. Can you introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony?
Yes, ma'am. Madam Chairman, my name is Robert Toms. I live in Lucilla. People know me as Cajun Bob. I'm a Vietnam combat veteran. I'm a recipient of the Silver Star Medal and 6 Purple Hearts. I've had chronic pain for over 45 years. I was diagnosed with severe rheumatoid arthritis 5 years ago. I was originally put on a medication that wasn't a biologic, and after 3 years, it almost killed me. I was then prescribed a biologic, Humira, 2 years ago, and went from being totally bedridden to now enjoying a functional life. I'm not 100%. But I can do things now, like my shopping at Fred Meyer here in Lucilla. I can help my wife clean house. We can prepare dinners together. Although it's been working, not 100%, I can do things, I can function. I don't know how to put it any stronger, but to say that this biologic was a miracle. Although it's been working for me for almost 2 years, I don't know that it will always work. I was on an allergy medication for a while that eventually stopped working, and then put on a similar medication that began working. I'm told the same thing may happen with the biologics and Humira. If it stops working, I have a shot due in 2 days. If it doesn't work, I want to immediately have available any approved substitutions by the FDA. The real question is, why wait? In the first committee that we testified in front of, someone asked the question, what's the rush on this bill? I wish somebody would have asked me that. We need this bill now so that when substitutes are approved by the FDA, they are immediately available to us. I and other Alaska patients wouldn't have to wait for legislation to pass, God knows when, to approve it. On behalf of myself and my wife, please pass SB 32. As it's written without amendments, my wife Cindy Caserta, who is my caregiver, also a chronic pain patient, and is an ambassador for the U.S. Pain Foundation, would like to say a few words. I'd like to give a shout out to Representative David Eastman, West Point graduate, Captain in the Army. We are so proud of you and Marcella. Thank you, sir, for being interested and attending this meeting. God bless you. Semper Fi.
Thank you, Mr. Toms. Ms. Caserta?
Hello. Thank you for allowing me to speak today. I'm Bob's wife and caregiver, and I'm a chronic pain sufferer myself. And I'm also here as an ambassador for the U.S. Pain Foundation, and they support this bill. Last weekend, in the National Pain Report website, I saw a study of 6,200 rheumatoid arthritis patients who are on biologics. This was a study done by Dr. Vibeck Strand at Stanford. Over one-third of those patients stop taking a biologic within 2 years because of a loss of effectiveness. Biosimilars could be the answer for Alaska residents who are in similar situations. If Bob's Humira stops working, I want him to have every opportunity to try other FDA-approved biosimilars as quickly as possible. Please pass this bill so Alaska patients can have the opportunity to have these biosimilars as they become available. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Caserta. Are there any questions for Ms. Caserta or Mr. Toms while we have them? All right. Was that a yes or a no?
Real quick.
Representative Eastman.
I just want to thank you very much for your testimony and appreciate your being willing to lay out all the details, and I think that will help the committee with the decision before us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
All right. On the off-net, we have Becky Holtberg with the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. Ms. Holtberg, are you ready?
Yes, thank you, Representative Funnell. For the record, my name is Becky Holtberg, and I'm the President and CEO of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association, and we support Senate Bill 32. Upon learning of this bill earlier in the year, we consulted with hospital-based pharmacists and physicians to ensure that the bill would supply the guidance needed to ensure safe and effective treatments for patients while providing the potential to lower pharmaceutical costs. Following this consultation, we made the decision to support the bill. Critical to our support for this legislation are the specific communication requirements and timelines for pharmacists associated with dispensing biosimilar medication. The legislation includes a 3-day timeline for the pharmacist to notify the prescribing physician and offers flexibility in communication methods to meet the needs of pharmacists in a variety of settings. We believe that SB 32 strikes the right balance for notification and communication. Biosimilars and interchangeable biological products offer potential accessibility and affordability as they provide competition for biologic drugs in a similar way that generic drugs do for brand name drugs. We believe that SB 32 protects patients and will benefit the state of Alaska. Please let us know if there's anything we can do to advance this legislation moving forward, and thank you very much to the committee for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Holtberg. Are there any questions for Ms. Holtberg from the committee? All right, seeing none, thank you very much. Phil Schneider with the Alliance for Safe Biologic Medicines. Are you on the line, Mr. Schneider?
Yes, thank you very much. My name is Phil Schneider. I'm speaking on behalf of the Alliance for Safe Medication and Biologic Medicines, which is an organization advocating the safe use of these new life-saving medicines. We are testifying in support of Alaska Senate Bill 32. In my day job, I am also a pharmacist and a pharmacy professor at the University of Arizona College of Pharmacy. So if there are questions related to the impact on pharmacy, I'm happy to address those. As heard, biologics are life-saving medicines. They're also very expensive medicines, and interchangeable biosimilars offer the opportunity to bring price competition into this important category of medicines. They're different than generic medicines, however, in that their molecular structures are different, and so current laws that relate to the substitution of medicines based on what are prescribed are no longer up to date, and that's why this bill is necessary. If not passed, the pharmacist would not be able to respond quickly to a patient's needs if a less expensive interchangeable biologic was available without contacting the physician, which often takes a fair amount of time because of their different locations, et cetera. And so we feel that when the FDA classifies a biologic as interchangeable, the pharmacist ought to be able to do that at the point of care and offer potential cost savings to the patient without providing any additional risk to the patient. However, we do feel that communication between the prescriber and the pharmacist is essential because these are not identical medications, even though they are considered interchangeable. And so we support that communication after the dispensing takes place within a reasonable time frame, and we feel that 3 days is a reasonable time frame. This bill also requires record keeping of a substitution that's made for a period of 2 years so that if there are any unexpected adverse events that might occur, that those be able to attribute those to the product that's actually provided to the patient. So we, in summary, do not feel this imposes an unreasonable burden on pharmacists. It links the pharmacist and the prescriber together in providing a collaborative practice in the interest of the patient, and we think will favor improved access to this important category of expensive medicines by reducing their costs.
Does the committee have any questions for, I guess it's Professor Schneider?
Yes, whatever you want to choose. Call me Phil.
So this is Chair Sponholz. I have a question. One of the things that we've heard is that while clinically similar, there are pretty substantial differences, or can be pretty substantial differences, in terms of side effects and efficacy of interchangeables. I'm curious about your opinion on whether or not it's safe for pharmacists to recommend making changes at the pharmacy point of sale, rather than that coming directly from the doctor.
The prescriber?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, that's an excellent question. Let me just describe the whole the landscape. There are biologics, which are medicines that are produced by living cells, and those would include medicines like insulin, et cetera. Then there are biosimilars, which are biologics that are very similar in terms of their therapeutic effect and safety profile, but there may be minor differences that need to be considered, and those are not considered interchangeable. They're alternate medications that might be used when one stops working. They may be tried in a patient that might be having some problems with a certain medication. Then there's the third category, which is interchangeable biosimilars, and those are categorized by the Food and Drug Administration based on studies that have to be done that involve switching patients back and forth from the reference product to the biosimilar and then back and back again. And so that those switching studies have to demonstrate that the interchangeable biosimilar has no differences in terms of both its effectiveness and its safety. And so therefore, if the FDA, based on studies that are provided by the companies manufacturing them, can demonstrate that there's no difference in terms of effectiveness and safety, then they are considered an interchangeable biosimilar and can be safely interchanged. And so those are the three categories. This bill only relates to interchangeable biosimilars, namely those biosimilars that the FDA has considered to be interchangeable based on those switching studies. Does that make sense?
That was helpful. Thank you very much.
Yeah. And so that provides the pharmacist with, in fact, the FDA says that a pharmacist can switch the medicines back and forth because they're considered interchangeable. The purpose of these state laws, and Alaska is one of many that are passing these laws, is to assure the fact that there's communication with the prescriber, even though they're interchangeable, so that the prescriber knows that there's been an interchange, but that happens after the fact rather than beforehand.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony today, Phil.
Okay. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity.
All right. Next on the line, we have Carrie McClellan with the Colon Cancer Alliance.
Yeah, thank you. Good afternoon. I'd like to thank the committee for in advance for your efforts to pass SB 32 without any amendments. I'm from Anchorage, Alaska, and I've lived here 35 years, and I'm advocating for all cancer patients and also for the Colon Cancer Alliance. I was diagnosed in 2013 with stage 4 colon cancer, and I was on chemo and radiation, but they pulled me off it because it was, my body couldn't handle it. At any rate, I would like, I don't know if the biologics were available at the time, but it's important to pass this bill here so that all Alaskans can have the convenience of doing it here instead of going out on Route 48. I know biologics have successfully been used for colon cancer and other types of cancer. So I'm hoping that we can get this all passed.
to provide better options for all Alaskans. Another tool for the toolkit. More saving measures. Please vote to pass this bill now. Act Pleasant Bay.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. McClellan. Is there any questions for Mr. McClellan? All right, seeing none, have a very good day, and I wish you much health. All right, the next person on the off-net is Mark Guimond with the Arthritis Foundation. Please correct me on your name and proceed with your testimony.
It's Mark Guimond. I'm the Director of State Legislative Affairs for the Arthritis Foundation, and we fully support Senate Bill 32. As you probably know, arthritis is a lifelong chronic disease that can be debilitating. Biologics offer our population the way to benefit. Biologics change lives. It's the difference between a child being in a wheelchair or somebody not working and having a good quality of life. So we want to expand the market as much as possible to have biologics and biosimilars available to people with arthritis. The thing to understand is biologics are not small molecule chemical compounds. These are very complex medications because they're live cells, and because of that complication, they're also very expensive. Biologics are either 100% infused, IV infused, or injected. This is not a pill that you just pick up at the corner pharmacy and you take it home. Because these are such specialized medicines, they represent about 0.1% of all prescriptions filled at retail pharmacies. So this is a very, very small market, but it's a very significant market that changes people's lives. Our hope is that biosimilars will have the same effect on the market that generics did with small molecule chemical compounds. We think that this law is necessary now because if these were to come to market and then the legislature was not in session, we would have to wait then for the legislature to come back and pass the bill later on. We think that these are right around the corner. The first biosimilar is already in market. Alaska would be joining about 30, I think the count today is 30 other states. Kansas just signed their bill today, joining the others. The communication requirement that's in the bill, we find it's essential. The communication between the pharmacist, the doctor, and the patient creates a complete medical record for our patients. And again, people with arthritis have comorbidities. It's a very debilitating disease. So we want to make sure that medical record is as complete as possible. In developing this bill in other states, we've worked with patient groups, we've worked with doctors, we've worked with the pharmacists. Again, going back, I think there's a huge burden that's going to be placed on the pharmacists. I think it's kind of a red herring. Again, these biologics and the biosimilars that are followed are 0.1% of all prescriptions filled at retail pharmacies. So I just don't see how the burden is going to be placed there. The offset to that burden, though, is the complete medical record that will be generated for a very, very fragile population. So the Arthritis Foundation fully supports Senate Bill 32 and the communication requirement between the pharmacist and the physician. Thank you.
All right. Are there any questions for Mr. Guimond? All right, seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony today. The last person we have on the off-net today, it looks like, is Dr. Thomas Felix with Amgen.
Good afternoon. My name is Thomas Felix. I am medical director with Amgen based out of our Washington, D.C. office. I'm testifying in support of SB 32, and I think many of the people who testified before me have covered the major points. I think the first testimony that described the components of the bill and the five provisions that are really key to its implementation. I just want to cover one of those provisions that is a departure from existing generic substitution law in Alaska, and that's the requirement to have a pharmacist communicate with a physician sometime following the substitution of an interchangeable biosimilar. At the heart of this is ensuring that members of the healthcare team are talking to one another. And this is just one example amongst many in healthcare where we're trying to create transparency and accessibility to information when it's needed. So there have, it's probably important to note that there are two other arguments in this regard, right? So we're saying that substitution should happen 3 days following, communication should happen 3 days following a substitution. There are those that are advocating for no communication to occur and that it's too burdensome. And we've seen this overcome in many states, 28 states that have already passed legislation. And I want you to know that we've actually worked with stakeholders and pharmacists to ensure that their perspectives are actually included in this bill to make it less burdensome in the future for them. But the other thing that I want to, the other perspective is to somehow allow for communication prior to the substitution. And that really goes against the spirit of the designation of interchangeability. In the federal law that allowed for the biosimilar pathway to come into existence, the description of interchangeability is one where the pharmacist can exercise their discretion to substitute without the consent of a prescriber. And if we were now to say that a pharmacist would need to go seek essentially consent from the prescriber beforehand, there would be in direct conflict with the federal law and the designation. I also want to say that that would go against the concept of access that we're trying to achieve with these designated interchangeable products. And I want, and the other thing that I think is important to understand is that pharmacovigilance or drug safety surveillance, which is what this communication facilitates, is not just something that's needed for biosimilars, but it's required for all biologics. And what we're trying to do is ensure that somehow biosimilars are not excluded from this important ability to surveil and check for drug safety. The last thing I just want to touch upon before I answer any of your questions are, there's also been some discussion about the need for legislation now and why is it that we need legislation now. And I just wanted to remind the committee that there are currently four approved biosimilars in the United States. Two of those have yet to be to enter into distribution and supply in the United States, but two of those products are self-administered, and they're the type of products that would be dispensed by a pharmacist under this current piece of legislation. And what this legislation does is it provides clear terms of use to all members of the healthcare team and to patients in terms of how to use these new products. I also want to draw your attention to a recent draft guidance for interchangeability that was released at the beginning of this year. It is a guidance that is intended to provide clarity to the community in terms of what's required to receive an interchangeability designation. I know that Dr. Schneider had talked about the important component of having switching studies. It contains a number of other things, and I won't overwhelm you, but I'm happy to answer questions if you have them. But if you had the chance to hear Dr. Gottlieb, who is being considered to be the FDA commissioner, in his confirmation hearing, when asked about the price of drugs and how to control the price of drugs, one of the first things he talked about was advancing and finalizing this interchangeability draft guidance. The other thing that I also want to share is the FDA is very busy in developing biosimilars. They have met with 64 distinct development programs that are trying to mimic 23 reference products that are going to be coming off patent or already have come off patent. So there is a need right now to ensure that the pharmacists, physicians, healthcare community, and patients have a clear understanding of how to use these products, both when they're interchangeable and, most importantly, also when they're not interchangeable and should not be substituted. Again, I just want to underscore the idea that interchangeables and biosimilars, luckily we have a very effective regulatory authority in our nation, and the FDA has set an appropriate scientific bar for approval of these products so that when they are approved, they will be they will be highly similar to a reference product that already exists, and differences in efficacy and safety should not be a concern. And when an interchangeable is approved specifically, it really signals to us that there isn't a concern of switching these products back and forth between the original product and the interchangeable. In closing, I just want to share that there are so many technologies and efforts in our nation to try to address grievous illness, illnesses that we may not have a current medication or a technology for. And what we require as we advance new technologies is to ensure that there are the appropriate safety measures in place to utilize these technologies and to ensure that patients who are suffering from grievous illness are comforted by knowing that we are passing the appropriate measures that can comport with the new technologies. So I do want to just ask if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Felix. Does anybody on the committee have a question for Dr. Felix while we have him? All right, seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony today. Our last testifier is in the room. If Crystal Koneman could come to the front, introduce yourself and give us your testimony, that would be fantastic.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Crystal Koneman. I'm a crier, I'll just tell you that. This is a personal issue for me. I'm a mother of two. I also have ankylosing spondylitis. I use a biologic. I started Humira 4 years ago. Fall of 2013, I took Humira for the first time. It was the first time in probably 6 or 7 months that I was able to pick up my three-year-old, throw him around. How you see me on a day-to-day basis is a result of a biologic. I am able to function because of them, and I love them. But they are scary. They change your chemical makeup, and you are no longer the same. This past summer, as my neurologist believes, as a result of my usage of Humira, I developed three lesions on my brain. If I hadn't have been taking Humira, he would have said without question, I had MS. I was bedridden again. And in that moment, I thought I was going to die. Like, I was miserable. Since then, luckily, good old medical science, I was able to recover from those, but I was also unable to take biologics again until about 2 months ago. They give me my life, but I'm on a name brand, and I rely on that name brand. My concern with biosimilars is that the insurance companies will say there are these similars on the market, we are no longer going to cover the name brands. They've done that for other generics, and they may change their formularies to moving the name brand down on the list. And that scares me. But on the flip side, I also understand that there are others who cannot afford the cost through insurance or other means. There are also the biosimilars that they may work for a person where the name brands don't, because there is such a difference. Slight difference can make all the difference in the world for a person. And I'm not here, Madam Chair, to testify against this bill. I love this bill because it gives people choice. But I also don't want my choice taken away as a result or an unintended consequence of this. And that scares me. You know, you've heard all of the doctors and the experts testify as to why this is needed. I've had to become my own medical professional to fight. Luckily, I have a great medical team, and they understand those small nuances. I can't take any other biologic that may, in some way, shape, or form, affect the nervous system because of what Humira did for me. So if a pharmacist looks at me and says, here, take this one. It's close. It's a biosimilar. It's approved. It's almost identical to what you're taking. That scares me. But luckily, I have a good enough medical team to where they would, I believe, specifically mark on my prescription whether or not a biosimilar would be best for me. I worry about those that don't have as good of medical professionals as I have, that they look at them as they're one in, you know, 1,000 or 8,000 or a million, however many patients they may see, and they may not put that on their prescription. And the fear of somebody else experiencing what I experienced this last summer scares me. Having to look at my kids, not know if I was going to be there. I don't like testifying on personal bills. This is the first time I've ever done it. But I just want you to be cautious. And I'm available for questions if you have any.
Thank you, Ms. Kuhneman, for making yourself vulnerable in this way. It's very challenging to do that in a work setting, but you've illuminated, I think, a very important issue, and I appreciate your being so courageous in doing so. Thanks. Are there any questions for Ms. Kuhneman? Thank you. All right, and with that, I'm going to close public testimony. Are there any amendments from the committee? All right. I have an amendment that I'm going to move, I'm going to discuss, and then I'm going to withdraw. I move Amendment 1. Okay. Thank you. So given today's testimony, I've learned a lot about biologics in the last week. And, you know, we've learned today that there's sort of a tsunami of biologic interchangeables coming down. I think the testimony from Dr. Felix with Amgen sort of indicated that there's about 41, maybe, biologic interchangeables that may be coming down the pike and are working their way through the FDA process. And, you know, I've learned how important biologics are to those who take them. I think certainly Ms. Kuhneman's testimony helps us to understand the transformative nature that they can have for people. I also talked with a father yesterday whose child takes a biologic and that costs about $2,000 a day. These are not inexpensive drugs. These are life-giving drugs, but they're also very expensive. And so I drafted an amendment, which, as I mentioned, I'm going to withdraw, but which would require that health insurance plans provide coverage for biological products would provide coverage for them, both interchangeables and biologicals themselves, without prior authorization. If the biological product or interchangeable product is to be dispensed as prescribed. And the reason that language would basically means that an insurance provider, a certain insurance company, would be required to cover the medicine that's prescribed by the doctor, not necessarily the cheapest one in every case, because as we heard in testimony, that you know, a small difference can have a very big impact on the health and well-being of somebody, because the amendment was drafted in anticipation of a problem that we haven't seen is actually there. I'm going to withdraw the amendment, but I want to make sure that everybody is, it's out there that we feel strongly that people with serious health care issues in the state of Alaska be able to have those covered by their insurance providers, and that these not be treated lightly, and that cost isn't the only consideration when it comes to health care. Representative Keto.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for putting the amendment forward. I appreciate the effort behind it, and I do recall back, I think it was back in the 1990s when we went through a big burgeoning effort of the generic regular drugs versus name brand drugs, and they were also not chemically almost the same, but there were some variations allowed, and there were some people that reacted adversely to those subtle variations, and we went through a process where the pharmacists and the doctors had to learn basically how to prescribe such that the correct medication got to the correct people. And I do think with the biologics, it is kind of a new world for us, and we don't know exactly what's going to happen, but I do hope and I do encourage that the insurance companies will be sensitive to providing for the medication as needed for the patient as identified by the patient's medical team. And I do think that this issue we will maybe, if we need to, address at a future date, but understand that it is not something that may need to be addressed right at this time.
Is there any other discussion of Amendment 1? All right. Seeing none, I withdraw Amendment 1. Are there any other amendments? Any other points of discussion from the committee? Representative Eastman.
I think it's a good bill.
All right. I would entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 32, Work Order 30-LS0188/J from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Are there any objections? All right. Seeing none, Senate Bill 32 passes from the committee. We're going to go and add ease to sign the paperwork. We are back on the record, and we're going to turn our attention to House Bill 176 by Representative Fansler. This is our first hearing on this legislation, so we will hear a presentation from the bill's sponsor. We'll take some invited testimony, and then set the bill aside for future consideration. Come on forward, Representative Fansler. If you and your aide could put yourselves on the record and present the bill, that would be wonderful.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Zach Fansler. I am the representative for District 38, which is Lower Yukon, Kuskokwim area, including Bethel. And with me,
Michelle Spark from Bethel, too, and aide to Representative Fansler.
All right. I believe that you have a blank CS that you would like the committee to consider.
We do have a CS that we would like the committee.
All right. I would entertain a motion to bring that document before the committee.
Madam Chair, I move that I turn the page. And I move that the Health and Social Services Committee adopt a blank committee substitute for House Bill 176, Work Order Number 30-LS0705/J, and adopt that as a working document.
All right. I will object for the purposes of discussion. All right, now you can walk us through the bill and the proposed changes.
And maybe I'll start at the 30,000-foot level, probably never descend lower than 25,000 feet, but there are people online that will be able to take us in through the nitty-gritty if needed. First off, let me just start out by saying that this is has a new title in the committee substitute, Emergency Medical Transportation Services, and this relates to the emergency transportation of patients. So what you should be thinking of is ambulances, really, if you're living on the road system. However, it also could be any type of transportation out of due to an emergency medical situation. such as, you know, by helicopter or by boat or by air plane. So these, as it currently stands, Alaska's emergency medical transport services typically are done by our fire departments on a municipality level or our EMS services, and currently they're compensated at a rate of 40% of the costs associated with transporting a Medicaid beneficiary. This means that they typically are operating at a loss, and what this bill is designed to do is to amend the state Medicaid plan so that they can now start to receive a full 100% recoup of their costs. This is the state can also benefit because it can collect a fee for administering the program, and it gives the ability for us to offset the cost of other Medicaid programs. It's likely that this will take 12 to 18 months for this program's implementation, but let me just give you some hard examples of why this is just so important. If you're looking at our largest boroughs, Anchorage, Juneau, Kenai, Ketchikan, combined, they serve 48% of the state's population. And these departments, along with Kenai, provided 7,035 transports to Medicaid patients, and without this enhanced program, they received just $2.1 million in reimbursements. Now, that was at 40% of what they could receive, so that means that they were essentially leaving $3.9 million on the table. This is valuable, valuable money that can help our municipalities and help our local communities at a time when they need it most, when we as a state may not be able to provide the services and help that we once did. To give you a further example, even a smaller community such as Bethel, which I'm obviously akin to, they could save see a savings of over $250,000 in EMTS reimbursements this year, which is a very, very valuable part to getting them to pay fully for the services. Aside from the supplementing the operating costs, these reimbursements will help enhance system delivery, and it can help our emergency transport services acquire much-needed equipment, provide for training, free up other funds that would allow them to give better services overall. This is something that I think is incredibly valuable for us. We have several folks that are here for invited testimony, and they can actually explain just how needed this service is. If I can briefly speak to the changes between the original version and the committee substitute, which I believe in front of you is /J, the committee substitute essentially changes the title. And originally this was entitled An Act Relating to Medical Assistance Reimbursement for Ground Emergency Transportation Services, and this is now a broader title, An Act Relating to Medical Assistance Reimbursement for Emergency Medical Transportation Services. The intention there is to include any kind of medical transportation, whether it be through on the ground, through the air, or by sea. So that's part of that. There's also been several changes that discussed the delineation between supplemental and enhanced reimbursement from the normal Medicaid reimbursement. This is important language because as the bill currently exists, it is possible to interpret that the supplemental and enhanced reimbursement consists of the entire amount of federal financial participation. We want to make sure that they're able to access 100% reimbursement, which is really what we want for our municipalities and for our emergency transports to be able to access. The final part is the amount of the supplemental reimbursement must be equal to the amount of federal financial participation that the department receives as reimbursement for the provider's cost for the ground, air, and sea emergency medical transportation services. So this is to help the providers supply matching funds, and what it does is it offsets some of the department's administrative expenses. So. And I'm more than happy to answer any questions you may have for myself or for my staff or Michelle, or we can go to invited testimony.
All right, super. Representative Keto?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Fansler, so question I have is in relation to the types of services. Do the entities that would be eligible for reimbursement have to meet some kind of licensing or registration status?
Yes, they do. And perhaps when we speak with Health and Human Services, they would be able to speak better to what those requirements are. But, yeah, they do need to be licensed so that they can already, and in this case, they're already receiving and transporting Medicaid. They're getting reimbursed, just not for the full amount.
Okay. So. Follow-up or question? Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Fansler. In regard to the ground transportation versus, say, an air ambulance situation, it does seem to me, at least from my experience, that there's a significant difference for how those services are provided and paid for. And I am wondering if there is a way that we can get a clear understanding of the cost structure or the payment structure for, say, an air ambulance versus ground transportation for medical emergencies.
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Keto, for that question. I believe that I'm probably not qualified to walk us through there as well as we can, so I'm going to defer, and in this case, probably Health and Human Services would be able to best give us that information, and I will defer to them at this time. And if you want, we can put together a comprehensive kind of database that we can speak to you about. I do believe in your packets you do have kind of the different codes that should be listed for the types of transportation. If I may, it should look like just kind of a different, it's really a double-sided graph or chart, excuse me, that shows kind of just an outline of what we're doing right now here in the state as of July 1st.
Thank you.
Yep. Okay. Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you. Through the chair. Hi, Representative. Quick question. I was just trying to think of stats in my head. Can you tell me how many folks are actually using, for example, ambulances to get to a particular hospital that actually either pay cash, are they able to bill insurance, or is there just a large number of what may be considered Medicaid, Medicare care patients that are being identified, and that's where the need is then for this particular legislation?
Thank you, and through the chair, thank you for that question, Representative Sullivan Leonard. I can speak to some of that. Once again, I'll let the experts tell you more, but my understanding is we average about 15,000 transports that are processed per year for the state. That's a total breakdown, to my understanding. And, of those, you do have all the varieties. And I can speak a little bit to how it goes. I know, at least from the presentations I've gotten in Bethel, and I do believe we have our fire chief online. He can speak to it much more, at least for our for Bethel. But it's my understanding if there's a Medicaid patient, then they get the Medicaid, the reimbursement through that program. If there is, I know in Bethel, there's kind of a flexibility, I think, in our municipal code that say if you're not Medicaid and you don't have insurance and you were going to be forced to pay out of pocket, there is a way that Bethel can choose to waive the fee for you if you would be somebody that would, obviously need some kind of, rather than, leave you and not take you to the hospital, they will always get you there and then kind of worry about it later. So,
You've referenced two different people in terms of resources on this particular question, and I think both of these questions are related to the CS, so we should continue down this path. We have on the line for questions Margaret Brody, who's the Director of Healthcare Services for the State of Alaska, for questions. And then we also have Bill Howell with the City of Bethel. Is that the fire chief that we're talking about? I'm not sure where you'd like to start in terms of making sure that we get the right answer to the questions.
I'm going to defer to your expertise as a committee, Madam Chair, and perhaps maybe in the order they came, and we can go from there.
Margaret Brody, are you on the line?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Did you hear the questions? Representative Keita is going to restate his question for you.
Thank you, Ms. Brody. So the first question really is how are the transport services regulated? So I guess is there licensing? Are they affiliated with a medical facility? Or I guess it's just one of these things that I've never really thought much about. But how do they demonstrate that they are a designated carrier for emergency services?
Through the chair, Representative Keto, this particular bill is talking about government entities that provide these services. And so they would have to be a government entity and also be involved in the Medicaid program as a Medicaid provider.
Okay, and the follow-up, Ms. Brody, so how many communities in Alaska would that cover then? Because I do know that there are several communities that have nonprofit medical or for-profit medical service providers.
Representative Keto, through the chair, I would have to get back with you with the exact number of communities. Pretty much it's any of the larger boroughs and municipalities and a few of the smaller ones, but I will get you that exact number.
Okay, thank you.
Did you have further questions for Ms. Brody?
I'm trying to remember what my other question was.
I think it was the difference between marrow and... Yeah.
And actually, this might not be a valid question, I guess, thinking in terms of being municipal services only. The air ambulance question might actually not be applicable. Is that the case?
Through the chair, Representative Keto, as far as I know, but I will also double check on that. I don't know if there's some rescue units that are run by municipalities or government entities.
Okay, and that information would be helpful. Thank you.
All right. Representative Sullivan Leonard has a question as well for you, Ms. Brody.
Through the chair, Ms. Brody, now I have to think of how my question was phrased. I guess I was trying to figure out how many transports we have in a given year, and Representative Fansler said there's about 15,000 transports yearly. I was trying to figure out how many of those are actually eligible for insurance reimbursement, Medicaid, Medicare reimbursement, or how many are actually self-paid for reimbursement for travel. Is that about right?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, I can only give you the amount of Medicaid ground transportation, and that was 15,362 a year. I do not have the figures for private insurance or for Medicare. Mm-hmm.
50,362.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Brody. I believe that we also have Bill Howell on the line. Representative Keto, did you want to talk to Fire Chief Howell? All right. All right, are there any other questions for the bill sponsor, his staff on the committee substitute? All right, with the changes explained by Representative Fansler and company, I'm going to remove my objection to adopting the CS. Are there any further objections to adopting the CS? All right, seeing none, the CS is now before the committee. And we will turn to invited testimony. All right, I think first we have on the line is Fire Chief Bill Howell from the City of Bethel. Mr. Howell, can you introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bill Howell. I'm the Mayor Chief of the City of Bethel. Thank you for inviting me today. I've served with the City of Bethel as a Fire Chief for a little over 2 years, and then my 25th year with the department. I'm speaking today to share a little bit about the challenges we face providing emergency medical care in Bethel, and I'm also here to very strongly support House Bill 176 and talk about how it will help EMS in our region and the state. I'm very excited at the tremendous opportunity before us, the impact House Bill 176 will have on Alaska's EMS service providers will be positive, significant, and long-lasting. The Bethel Fire Department consists of 7 career staff and about 25 volunteers. Last year, Bethel Fire responded to 1,335 medical calls per service. We saw our highest EMS call volume of the last 34 years in 2016. EMS call volume has increased by 10% per year over the last 6 years. The City of Bethel receives the majority of our funding through local sales, lodging, and alcohol taxes, and the rest is collected through community support, PILT, and fees for services that we provide, like ambulance service. An in-house analysis that we did recently found that we were losing about $972,000 per year in our ambulance service. When we look at our payer mixes for 2016, we saw that Medicaid recipients are the largest users of our services. Medicaid pays an average of $455 per call, and with our underlying cost of service in Bethel at $1,287 per transport, there's a heavy burden on the City of Bethel to continue providing these services. Bethel Fire Department's financial needs are significant. We need additional staff to cover the increased EMS call volume that we're seeing, and we need about $1.5 million to replace an aging ambulance, a 1980 tanker, and a 1980 ladder truck. Our fleet breaks down frequently and cannot respond. We have no backup or mutual aid here in Bethel, so it's all the more critical that we have the funds that we need to provide for dependable equipment. We've made efforts to increase revenue here. We've increased our ambulance fees last year. We're currently working on another increase in fees. We work closely with our third-party biller to ensure we are getting the maximum allowed and that our services are properly documented. We raise funds through our volunteer group and write grants for staffing and equipment. The City of Bethel has also made capital requests to the legislature for vehicles over the last 3 years for a new tanker and ladder truck. House Bill 176 would reimburse local EMS providers for the uncompensated cost of providing care to Medicaid recipients, and then, of course, give a 20% administrative fee to the state. Myself and many other fire chiefs are counting on GEMT, or EMTS legislation as it is now, to help generate funds needed to get the staffing and equipment we need to sustain or improve our current levels of service. The Alaska Fire Chiefs, the Bethel Fire Department, the Bethel City Council are ready and motivated to see this legislation through. And I'd like to close with thanking Zach Fansler for introducing House Bill 176. And thank you, Chair Sponholz, and the members of the committee for your attention and inviting me today. I'm definitely interested in this bill passing out of committee, and I can take any questions if you have any.
Are there any questions for Mr. Howell? All right, seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony today. All right, next.
Thank you.
Next up we have on the off-net, Alex Boyd with the Anchorage Fire Department. Want to introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony, Mr. Boyd?
Yes, thank you. My name is Alex Boyd. I'm the Assistant Chief of the Anchorage Fire Department in the Municipality of Anchorage. Hello to the Chair and the members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this afternoon. For the Municipality of Anchorage, House Bill 176 represents an opportunity for us to seek this supplemental reimbursement, as Chief Howell just spoke of, at a much larger level. For us, the scale of this issue is growing exponentially and impacting us in a means that is becoming almost unmanageable. We've had nearly a 74% increase in Medicaid recipient transports in the last year from 15 to 16. In 2016, we saw 6,721 transports for Medicaid recipients. Currently, at the 40% reimbursement rate, the Municipality of Anchorage is actually seeing an unrecovered cost of nearly $3 million in this process. House Bill 176, and its ability to seek that supplemental reimbursement, will provide a dramatic impact to the service of the Municipality of Anchorage, the Anchorage Fire Department, and allow us to improve our system delivery and our impact on our city tremendously by recovering that potential. If trends continue as they go today, you're expecting to see over $3.2 million in unrecovered expenses
for the calendar year 2017 with an expected transport rate over 7,000 for 2017. At the currently provided 40% reimbursement rate, Anchorage is collecting about $440 of the increased fee for us is $926 per transport as it sits. With this significant impact on our budget, we're seeing challenges in actually expanding our staffing to meet the need, the growing needs of the city. I would echo Chief Howell's comments on how much we appreciate the committee's consideration in moving this bill forward, and also Representative Fantler's support and sponsorship of the bill. I'm open for any questions if you have any on the specifics and how it will affect the Anchorage Fire Department.
Do we have any questions for Mr. Boyd? All right, seeing none, thank you for your testimony today. And then in person in the room, we have Rich Etheridge with the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I hope to answer some of the questions you guys have today. My name is Richard Etheridge. I'm the president of the Fire Chiefs Association. I'm also the fire chief here in Juneau. So I could talk to you about kind of the statewide perspective from the fire chiefs as well as some of my local experience here in town. As you know, Alaska's EMS delivery system is the most complex and diverse in the nation. We've got challenges that you see in very few other places. With that, medical care is expensive. Just getting to patients sometimes costs a department thousands of dollars just to get access to a patient, whether we have to charter a helicopter, work with the Coast Guard, the National Guard, Good Samaritan boats. Some fire departments are fortunate to where they have their own boats for doing patient transports. So. In these trying financial times, as you guys know, there is an increasing demand on the EMS services. And it's making it very difficult for volunteer fire departments and career fire departments to meet the growing needs. House Bill 176 provides the authorization to develop a program where local agencies can recover some of the costs for providing these emergency medical services. And this covers just the patients covered under the Medicaid system. This simply gives us the start to start working on a program. Alaska did participate in the Medicaid expansion program, and that has had a significant impact on emergency services. Here in Juneau alone, our patients that we've transported that are covered under Medicaid more than doubled. In years past, we would transport about 300 patients, and just the first year, that jumped to 800 patients. And we're not seeing any slowdown in call volumes here locally as well. Call volumes across the state for all calls for service are increasing. It used to be a 2-3% increase every year for fire departments. Here in Juneau, we saw a 13% jump, and we're anticipating the same type of jump again this year. That's not uncommon across the state anymore. As you heard from the other chiefs, Medicaid does not reimburse departments for all of the expenses. We took an average, the average cost for providing a basic life support transport is $1,680. And as you heard, Medicaid pays about $455 of that. The rest of that gets absorbed by the fire department or the local community and the taxpayers. Some of the key takeaways, this program utilizes funds that are already set aside by the federal Medicaid program just for this purpose. It's not tied to Medicaid expansion or the Affordable Care Act. So if those get rolled back or modified, this shouldn't affect this program. The state is able to collect administrative fees up to 20%, so this could be just increased revenue from $2.5 to $3 million being put back into the state of Alaska system. We've anticipated and estimated that this could be between $12 and $15 million put into the local economies at the local level for fire departments. Other states on the West Coast are already doing this program. California is kind of the flagship. We're working with one of the fire chiefs from there that is retired, and he's helping states set this program up across the nation. So there's currently several already with this in place, and there's several more in the same position we're in, trying to introduce legislation right now. This program will provide some funding at the local level where communities are being asked to carry more financial loads. It's estimated this could bring in $10 to $15 million down to our local level. In closing, Alaska relies heavily on our emergency medical services. House Bill 176 provides a foundation for your first responders and local communities to recover some of the desperately needed financial support and stability across the state. I would ask you to support Alaska's emergency responders in their time of needs by supporting and passing House Bill 176 and trying to get it signed into law this year. And I'm available to answer any questions.
Does anybody on the committee have questions for Chief Etheridge? All right. Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you. Thank you for your service. Please know how much we appreciate you. Quick question with regard to reimbursement of services with regard to transportation. Does the borough then pick up part of that tab through local sales tax or property tax?
Through the chair, yes. The fire departments have to budget for it, and mm-hmm. most fire departments are funded out of general fund or fire service area funds. So it does come directly out of the taxpayers.
Okay. Follow, Madam Chair. Please. And so with the implementation then of this particular legislation, would that then help free up some funds then from local taxation?
It would be up to each municipality how they would do that, but it would provide money back into the local municipalities in order to manage the funds how they're financial directed.
Sure. And do we know how much that may possibly be through the chair?
Each community is different. Mm-hmm. We've estimated Anchorage could see up to $4 million based on some old call volume. We looked at Nome. That was anticipated about $16,000 annually. Juneau, we were anticipating between $600,000 and $1 million annually.
Did you have a question, Representative Kito?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chief, for being here. I appreciate your testimony. So it seems like statewide we're seeing an increase in calls. Is there any research or any information on what has been driving the recent increase in emergency calls?
Through the chair, we're actively researching into that right now. Some of it is more people are eligible for health care, and so they're not self-payers anymore. Mm-hmm. It's harder and harder to get into primary care providers, so a lot of people are turning to your emergency rooms and your EMS systems for that primary care.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Representative Johnston.
Yes, thank you. Representative Kito asked part of my question, and just I've read nationally, if it's all right to mention it, that with Medicaid expansion, it has actually impacted emergency rooms far greater than anything. They are, the usage has gone up nationwide. The good news is with that is that the emergency rooms are now being reimbursed. The bad news, the policy that they were trying to drive isn't happening. But I didn't realize that it went down to also to the EMS. My question is, my second question through the chair, is would this be something that also your volunteer fire departments could participate in?
Through the chair, yes, it does. Any fire department that is eligible to bill and does bill for EMS services is able to participate in this program. So I would imagine several other departments that currently aren't trying to recover their costs now, we'll start doing that or consolidate with other local jurisdictions that are close by to do so.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right. Do we have any other questions for Chief Etheridge? All right. And we have Scott Klo. Is this your?
Yes.
All right. On the off net, it looks like we've got Scott Klo with AP Triton. Does that sound right?
Correct. He's the contractor working with the Fire Chiefs Association.
All right. Mr. Clark, did you want to present any testimony or address any of the comments that have come up today?
good afternoon. My name is Scott Clough. I'm a retired assistant chief with Sacramento Metro.
And in my retirement, I started consulting to fire agencies in multiple states that are looking to pursue this. My history is I built the very first program in the country in California, and since that time, I've introduced legislation and currently are working on SPAs in four other states, and I have five states that are currently doing legislation now. The thing that I would like to add, there was a couple of questions that were posed, and I don't want to speak on behalf of the state Medicaid director. In my initial research with Alaska, there's approximately 55 agencies that we have absolutely identified as being eligible to participate in this program. Of those 55, one of them is a university system, and the other one is a healthcare district. So it's not just fire departments that can participate. The other thing I'd like to bring a little bit of clarity on is when we talk about public providers, 42 CFR 433.5 identifies public agencies that are eligible to participate in these programs. And they basically are public agencies and what are called 638 recognized Indian tribes or First Nation peoples. But that does not preclude private enterprise from benefiting from this. And so the advantage to this program is, while you may have some municipalities that utilize the services of a private provider, if those public entities are subsidizing the private provider, they can be restructured so that they're drawing down these revenues to help offset that. And the same applies for your nonprofits and your volunteers. My experience has shown that volunteer agencies, in some case, have a much higher cost than even your paid urban areas, because the call volume is less, but the costs are still constant. Mm-hmm. So it's very common to find volunteer or nonprofit organizations that actually have costs that are equal or higher than our larger municipalities, and they see a tremendous benefit from this program. The other thing that I think is important to bring out, and it's very important with Alaska from the research that I've been able to gather on your state, this is a emergency medical transport bill. However, what we need to remember is that this is tied to a federal cost structure for providing those services. So what that really means is that as a municipality or a provider puts together programs, those programs, if they relate to the emergency medical services that are being provided, can count as a cost. So as an example, if the city of Juneau decided that they needed to replace all of their extrication equipment, and they had to invest $100,000 or $200,000 to buy new extrication equipment, and they needed to purchase a new squad to put that equipment on, even though that's not a transport vehicle, that is a unit and equipment that is utilized for emergency medical services delivery. So that cost on your following year's cost report is rolled into your new cost of service. So just because one year you filed a cost report and you received $1 million in reimbursement, you may find that over the course of that year, you put together an EMT training academy, you purchase some rescue equipment, you purchase two additional ambulances. Well, you've just raised the cost of your service by maybe $1.5 million. That counts towards your cost of service. So you're actually going to be able to draw down federal funds to help offset that equipment, that training, those classes that you put together for the delivery of emergency medical services. So I think that it's important to remember that there's a lot more to the bill than just the transport component. There is tremendous benefits to your community. It is a tremendous benefit to your Medicaid beneficiaries, because it gives you an opportunity to expand your services and be able to recoup some of that investment that you're putting into your delivery of EMS. I also commend the state and your participants that you included other forms of transportation. Alaska is like no other state that I've worked with, and it's very important, I think, that you address the fact that you have the opportunity to bring both land and air, fixed wing and rotor wing, into the mix. And there's lots of opportunities to facilitate contracting through municipalities where traditionally some of these providers may not see a benefit. There can be a benefit to both the community and some of these providers that may become contract providers. And if, with that, I'd be happy to address any other questions that you may have.
All right, are there any questions for Mr. Clough? All right, seeing none, thank you very much for calling in today. That was informative. This is a very interesting bill. I want to thank Representative Fansler, his staff. I want to thank Chief Etheridge and everybody else who testified today. We're going to set this bill aside for future consideration right now, as per the tradition of this community. The time is 3:33 p.m. This hearing of the House Health and Social Services Committee is now adjourned. Mm-hmm.